And in many ways, this, I think, survey has confirmed what we've been hearing anecdotally for some time, that our churches are seeing more people coming into church, more people interested in Christianity, more conversions, more baptisms. We heard that from a number of churches.
More than what? Just last year or more than in quite a long period of time, really?
Well, I would say more than in certainly the 15 years that I've been National Director of the FIEC. Yeah. And I would say probably more than in the 35 years that I've been a Christian. Yeah.
Hello and welcome to Independence, the FIEC podcast for church leaders. Thank you so much for joining us for our end of year review. Hello, John.
Hi, Adrian.
Christmas turkey packed away, all the rest of it. New year not quite upon us. This is our kind of New Year's Eve wrap up. You know, like one of those New Year's Eve programmes? I'm guessing you're a Jules Holland person, are you?
Yep.
Do you watch the fireworks?
Yep, we normally get together to watch those. That's great fun.
Good. Well, there we are. I enjoyed living in London and actually being able to see the fireworks in person. But I find fireworks a bit boring, really. After a while, they all look the same, I think. This has been a year of not things looking the same, though. Quite big changes happening, and we're going to reflect on those as we think about the year. So I hope it's an encouraging look back at the year as we reflect on all that the Lord's been doing. And perhaps the big thing we need to talk about is the quiet revival. Whether that's the right description for it. I think the word revival needs to be reserved really for things that are even more significant than what's been going on. But something is going on, isn't it? There's certainly something in the air.
Oh yeah,
I mean, in terms of what's happening in gospel work.
That's been one of the really big stories of the year. The language of quiet revival is because that's the language used by the Bible Society to describe the results of their major survey, which is investigating kind of church attendance, comparing from a few years ago. And that survey has demonstrated that there has been a significant uptick in the numbers of people who are attending church on a regular basis, particularly amongst younger people and particularly amongst young men.
Which has been a group that's been largely missed out by the gospel, isn't it, for a long time, or so it seems.
Oh yeah, I think evangelicals for a long time have been bemoaning the fact that there are not so many men in church and there aren't so many young people in church. Yeah. So this is a significant change. And in many ways, this, I think, survey has confirmed what we've been hearing anecdotally for some time, that our churches are seeing more people coming into church, more people interested in Christianity, more conversions, more baptisms. We heard that from a number of churches.
More than what? Just last year or more than in quite a long period of time, really?
Well, I would say more than in certainly the 15 years that I've been National Director of the FIEC. Yeah. And I would say probably more than in the 35 years that I've been a Christian in terms of the response in churches. It seems to have been significant. And we heard it initially from one or two churches, and then suddenly it became every church was sharing. I remember our leaders' conference, not this year, but last year, where again we had a time where people texted in from their churches. And there was just an overwhelming number of stories about conversions, baptisms, people coming into church. So what we were observing anecdotally, to some extent, the Bible Society was demonstrating in a statistically stronger way.
Yes.
I think there's been lots of question of to the degree of the revival that they have pointed. So there have been some questions about their methodology and the conclusions that they've drawn from that.
So I think the liberal press especially seem to be taking every opportunity really to knock it down. But it is borne out by what we see on the ground.
It is, although I mean I think it's fair to say that the survey, it was self-reporting, and they counted a regular attendance at church of being once a month. So the degree of commitment involved there is perhaps easy to sort of overstate, but within it there's clearly something real that is happening. And it's not just the quiet revival, but the Evangelical Alliance did a survey of its churches.
That's
and
right,
they were also reporting that growth. Yeah. We have done a data survey of our own FIEC churches, and again that has reported significant growth in our churches. I think the quiet revival interestingly highlights that it's churches that are more conservative which are seeing growth, some theologically conservative and some conservative in a more traditional sense.
Yeah. What's going on there?
Well, I think people are sort of being attracted to things that are clear, things that have a strong sense of meaning and identity, that are speaking into their lives in a way that's compelling. People want something that is truthful, something that is authoritative. So
they're not turning up for wishy-washy.
No, they're not. They're not. So the growth has been in Roman Catholicism.
Yes, it's not just evangelical, is it?
Eastern Orthodoxy at one end of the spectrum, and it's been in Pentecostal churches. And I think probably the unnoticed group is the conservative evangelical churches at the other end of the spectrum. So it's those that are proclaiming a confident message that are attracting people, and that sort of middle liberal Christianity that is uncertain about what it really believes is not seeing.
We've known for a long time, haven't we? That's where the potential is. I mean, obviously, not only our convictions, but the data backs that up. There was a graph that was published, wasn't it, 5 years ago now, which was just looking at the denominations, so to speak, that were growing in the UK. And I think the three that were above the line of growth were the Free Church of Scotland, the FIEC, and the Reformed Church of God, I think.
Yeah.
And I think the data at the time was pointing out...
New Frontiers was
Or maybe New Frontiers,
right.
And the data was pointing out at the time, these are the people who believe in the Bible,
which
was a sort of slightly surprising to the liberal elite, and that would be attractive. But that we were only just above the line at that point, whereas this seems to be ramping that up a little bit.
It is, and I think it touches on the fact that there is a meaning crisis in people's lives. They're looking for significance. They're looking.
Is that
for
what's
identity.
Going on? Do you think?
Yes, I think so. I think in our society, people have a lack of hope. They have a lack of certainty as to who they are. They feel that they're living in a very fluid and changing context. And it's into those circumstances that Christianity, preached with confidence, is meeting a very clear existential, personal, spiritual need.
Yeah. What are some of the implications for our churches of this? It seems to me that it's, although it's extensive, it's not universal. So you may be a leader listening to this in a church and you think, well, actually, I haven't seen anybody turn up in the last 3 or 4 months. Everyone's talking about this and I haven't seen that. Am I doing something wrong? Is it so universal that if I haven't seen anybody turn up, I've missed the boat?
I wouldn't say it's universal. It is quite common.
Yes.
So across our 675 churches, I would say a good 2/3 at least would have seen some growth. So it's not universal. That partly depends on demography and where you are.
So it's especially towns and cities.
Towns and cities where there are plenty of young people.
Yeah.
Another phenomena here that is part of this is an increasing ethnic diversity of Christianity. So much of the growth is amongst those who are from a non-white British background. So a much higher percentage of churchgoers under the age of 55 are from a non-white background. So in communities in which there's quite a strong sort of ethnic presence, particularly those who've come from West Africa, Nigeria, the Caribbean, you're likely to see more significant Christian interest. So there's no doubt that underlying these figures, migration to the UK has played a significant part in that. So the growth of Catholicism can be explained by migration both from Eastern Europe and then increasingly from those coming from an African background who would be Catholic by culture. Again, Pentecostalism has seen significant growth partly as a result of migration to the UK. So the overall statistics demonstrate that more people are attending church, but we need to recognise that migration has contributed to that. And actually, I think as churches, we need to be grateful and thankful that, in a sense, that reverse mission that is bringing believers to the UK has been a sort of strengthening the work of the gospel in the UK. If our churches were only comprised of those who were born and brought up in Britain, white Britons, they would be considerably smaller than they are today. So I think we can be grateful for the way God has worked in that
way. So we're starting to touch there on some implications for church leaders, because obviously one of the implications is that churches are diversifying in terms of the backgrounds of people, the cultures that people come from. And that has huge implications for church life, doesn't it? You can't just go on as you have been. You have to reflect that somehow.
It does. And I think many of our churches are now seeing a much sort of broader spread of different ethnicities within their congregations. That's been a phenomena again over the last couple of years. Our own data survey has demonstrated that the vast majority of our churches are now ethnically mixed in their congregations. That's changed dramatically over the last 5 years. That's been a blessing to churches, and churches are beginning to have to think through what does that mean for the life of the local congregation. People coming with very different cultures, perhaps quite different theological experiences and church experiences, different tastes in the way that they would like to express themselves, the songs that they'd like to worship,
food they'd like to eat,
differences in food, very different understandings of family and what the church ought to be. So some of our patterns of church are deeply cultural, and we haven't really realised that. And so it's a challenge.
Especially this is a help to us, isn't it?
Because it is a help to us.
It is helping us see what is a biblical conviction, actually, what is just cultural history, essentially.
Absolutely. And churches are going to have to flex in order to accommodate those who've come, I think, and to make the most of the potential and the opportunity that that brings to the life of the local church. And with very significant migration, we're going to find that second and third generation children who are born and brought up within the church will have a slightly different outlook from their sort of parents. So I think that is an increasing challenge for local churches. Yeah. Interestingly, within FIEC, over the course of this last year, probably the area in which we've had most requests from our churches for help have been with how to bring about an intercultural ministry in the life of our churches. They realise that they need to change. They want to welcome people into the church. They want to help raise up leaders from different ethnic backgrounds to serve in the life of the church, to reflect the community and those who are there. But they find that challenging. They're afraid of taking cultural missteps and misunderstandings. Maybe there are some sections of the church that are resistant to change. So one of the areas we've really been investing in is our whole area of intercultural ministry. We're delighted that our colleague Justin Gill is now working part-time as our intercultural ministry advisor. We held a 24-hour a gathering after our leaders' conference called Anticipating Heaven, which was really thinking through how do you develop intercultural ministry in local churches. And I think for more and more churches, that is both a tremendous opportunity, but it's also going to be a challenge for leaders.
Right. Just back to the quiet revival stuff and people turning up at church. Give me some help here and some wisdom. I'm leading a service on a Sunday morning, or I'm preaching on a Sunday morning, as I would do as part of a regular ministry as a church leader. What sorts of things do I need to be thinking about more carefully now, given that you could well be someone who's never been to church before, someone who's just turned up, someone who knows nothing? You know, what are some of the things that I need to be perhaps just flexing in terms of ministry? What, you know, how I lead a service, the words that I use, the bits we incorporate in, and especially the preaching. Do those things need to flex because of this quiet revival stuff?
To some extent, yes. I mean, I think we need, if we're going to make the most of the moment of the opportunity and recognise what's happening, there may be things that we need to change. Although I think it's worth recognising that many of the conservative evangelical churches are preaching the gospel with clarity and with conviction. So I think in some ways the churches that have been seeker sensitive, that try to sort of organise everything in order to make people feel comfortable and at home, that downplay the truth of the Christian message, that make it as unreligious as possible, that actually isn't the reality of where most FIEC churches are located. And I think for churches that are a little bit more in that seeker-sensitive model, they've had to change quite considerably the way that they minister, and many of them are adjusting to a different cultural context. I think for FIEC churches and what they might be experiencing on the ground, I do think that it's probably important that we tap into the long Christian history, that actually we find ways in which we make clear that we stand in 2,000 years of Christian history.
What might some of those be?
That might be the use of some appropriate liturgy within the life of a church. Okay. So whether it might be making use of creeds in the life of the church, bringing those into the service. It may be adopting historic prayers and just demonstrating that we are not something new, something novel, but we can, in a sense, find our sort of place in the historic strand of the church. Telling and explaining our history and where we've come from and why we're who we are is hugely significant. So I do think that people want something that has deep historical roots and authenticity to be real. People are dissatisfied with modernity, its failure to deliver. And there is a natural, for some, looking back to that which is ancient, that which is traditional, that which has stood the test of time. And I think we need to find ways in which we show that we are sort of part of that historic church. We also need to explain why we're different. So some are looking back to Roman Catholicism and Eastern Orthodoxy, and to some extent, both of those traditions have even an even more ancient history than Protestantism and evangelicalism. And some people are attracted precisely because of that. And I think we need to be articulating very clearly that we stand on the basis of the biblical teaching about the church. We go back to the apostolic church. We affirm the core doctrinal convictions that the church came to ahead of the Reformation. But we also believe that the Reformation was a right recovery of biblical Christianity. Yeah. And therefore that we think that both the Roman Catholic Church and the Eastern Orthodox Church don't reflect a faithfully biblical Christianity.
So just to be clear, a little quiz for you, John. Buying a dog collar?
Well,
yes, no, no.
Well, I wouldn't ordinarily, but I mean, I actually think there can be a place for that in certain contexts. That opens up perhaps opportunities with chaplaincy, engaging people. For some, that might be a way in. And I think it's not a right or wrong. That's a judgment that needs to be made.
Bulk buying candles? Not so much.
No.
No robes going to appear at Christchurch Harbour. I guess we meet in a rented premises, as lots of FIC churches do. And I think in some ways that makes it a little bit harder for us. You know, we meet in a school. You look on the walls, you see schoolwork, and it doesn't feel like there's much connection with the past. It just looks like a rented space. I think you have to work a bit harder in those settings, don't you?
You do, although I actually think the danger here is that in part of this cultural shift back, there are plenty of people who will want to leap on that which is tangible and physical. Mm. So they're attracted to the building, they're attracted to clerical dress, they're attracted to, as you say, candles and the creation of a spiritual atmosphere. Again, as evangelicals, we are convinced that it is the work of the Word by the Spirit that God is
Amen.
At work.
Yep.
And I think actually we will find that in as Christians, we suddenly have different rivals mm-hmm. that we need to be critiquing. So we've been very used to saying that it's liberal Christianity that is our primary rival, and we've sought to critique liberal Christianity for its rejection of the gospel, its denial of the Bible, its introduction of kind of progressive ethics. Actually, we may well find that we need to similarly critique Catholicism, Eastern yep. Orthodoxy. Yep. I mean, even this year, it's been widely reported. I mean, we've had one FIEC church has left FIEC and become Eastern Orthodox. I've heard accounts of a CU president here in a university who became a Roman Catholic and had to step down. So the alternatives are now different.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think it's rather like in the 19th century, where you had the rise of the Oxford movement, kind of Keble, kind of Newman
yeah.
basically turning to Roman Catholicism because they felt that it offered a greater spirituality, an ancient connection. And our evangelical forebears, people like J.C. Ryle, people like Spurgeon and others, effectively had to critique that move back to Roman Catholicism. And it was very much bound up with its sacramental theology, its clerical dress, its buildings, which they felt was not the gospel. And also the core theological convictions about salvation and the nature of the church as the mediator between God and people that our evangelical forefathers critiqued. I think we will need to engage once again in some of those apologetics.
Yeah. I think one of the other things I think about church is we can't assume anything on a Sunday morning, and we should never be doing that anyway, but actually that's even more the case. I think we're hearing, aren't we, of people coming to faith really from zero background. They haven't been brought up in a Christian home. They didn't go to Sunday school. They didn't sing Christian songs at school. Or if they did, it was one more step along the world I got. You know, there's a very, very basic understanding of Christianity. And actually, at our recent leaders conference, we had a workshop on this that was discipleship from scratch. Because I think we're back at ground zero. You can't assume that people understand what basic Christian morality is, that what the basic Christian tenets of the faith are, which is both exciting. I think you've basically got blank sheets of paper, but is also, I think, a challenge to us because we're not really geared up to be discipling at that level. We're kind of geared up to assuming that, you know, people are kind of plugging in to existing structures because they have some innate Christian knowledge, whereas in fact they don't. They just don't. I think people know very little, don't they?
Well, I think it's actually slightly more complex than that, because I think you've got some people who are coming into church who know very little and are coming to church to investigate and find out. You're also finding people turning up at church who have been strongly influenced by the internet and what's online, that they've come to church because
there's stuff online, is there?
Well, I repeated story. Someone like Jordan Peterson becomes a gateway drug into finding out about Christianity. Yep. They get intrigued by Jordan Peterson, maybe a variety of podcasts, influencers who speak about the Bible. That then leads them to look to material which is more biblically faithful. And so people are turning up at church saying, I have been converted, but they've been influenced by a whole variety of podcasts, perhaps coming from a slightly more right-wing perspective and arriving at church with certain expectations as to what Christianity is and what it will involve. So you have a mix of people coming with very little knowledge and people coming with what they think is quite a lot of knowledge, but it's from particular sources. And the challenge is to disciple both of those groups and grow them into knowledge of Christ. Yeah. And I think churches are going to have to rethink their whole process of discipleship. And I think actually for evangelical churches where we've relied primarily on the preaching and small group Bible studies as a model of how to train people in the basics of Christianity, I think those are going to be less effective.
Yes, they'll be found wanting, won't they?
Interesting, there was a book published in the States this year, which was one of the Christianity Today prize winners. It was also the Gospel one of the Gospel Coalition prizes, which was talking about the need to rediscover catechesis. Which is basically the teaching of fundamental Christian doctrine to people who are new. And I think in the early church, people who became converts or were interested would go through a fairly intensive process of being instructed in the core truths of the Christian faith. And I think that is probably what we need to increasingly do. Basically because whether people have come with no knowledge at all or whether they've come thinking they've got knowledge, those foundations need to be absolutely laid. And whereas in the past the wider culture might have done that to some degree, I think now churches need to take responsibility for that.
Let's move on, John. I was run out of time. I think one of the other things, as I look back over the year, that seems to be a feature of the year, really, it's not just this quiet revival, it's that we're living in a more fractured world. And I think it seems to me that cashes out at all sorts of levels. It cashes out at a meta level in geopolitics. I think we've got Marmite leaders all around the world, including in our own country. People love them or hate them. It seems to be very polarised. I think it cashes out at a micro level in community cohesion and things like that. I think that's a fair assessment, isn't it? That the world seems to be more fractured, seems to be more divided.
I think that's right, more polarised at multiple levels. I think we see that particularly in politics. And in many ways, perhaps that is a return to the way that the world has often been. We've actually had a rather strange period in which there's been a sort of centrist consensus after the end of the Cold War. Certainly in Western countries, that's been a period generally of prosperity and progress. That, to some extent, came crashing to an end with the financial crash of 2008. And really, there's been relatively little growth and progress since then. And so I think people are deeply frustrated with politics, with the culture, with economics, with what they feel about their lives. They feel that politicians of both sides who would be more centrist have failed them. So people are desperate for something different.
So it's not just that people are shifting right, people are shifting to extremes, actually, rather than sometimes it's left, sometimes it's right.
We see that the parties that have been in the centre are largely being eclipsed by those that are more radical, either to the left or to the right. And I think that is because people have lost trust and confidence in those who have governed. And actually, that's a challenge for Christians, because actually different Christians will take those different political opinions. So in America, most Christians tend to be right-leaning. In Britain, the statistics still suggest that most Christians tend to be left-leaning in their political outlook. But yes, there is a polarisation. People increasingly think that the other side are evil and wrong, are destroying the culture. And so I think there is a much less willingness to tolerate and recognise that other people maybe have different positions.
How is that connected to the rise of populism and nationalism? Is that all part of the same phenomenon, do you think?
I think that is part of the same phenomenon. That's really one end of the spectrum, although one might say that the rise in the left is a left-wing populism.
So yes, populism, I was going to say, can go both ways.
Raises the question what you think populism means. I guess people tend to think of that as thinking there are sort of some fairly simple authoritarian answers that will sort out the problems in society, and that sort of leaders who embody that will be able to put things right in a way that others haven't done. Of course, the reality is often when people end up in government, they discover how complex the problems are, and it's very difficult for situations to be solved. So even some more populist leaders, once they're actually in office, like in Italy, have become more centrist in the way
that. And I think you see that at a micro level, don't you? I mean, I think I was listening to a podcast the other day reflecting on local government in the UK, and obviously there's been a significant shift in of the running of councils, especially towards the right wing and towards reform in the UK. But actually, once councils come in, discovering there's very little they can change.
Yeah.
The actual levers they've got to pull on don't make much of an impact. There are certain things that you have to provide. You don't have any choice about that. And so actually, there aren't huge savings to make.
Yeah.
And it's difficult to make a difference. And in that sense, populism quickly disappoints, doesn't it?
And I think in Britain in particular and other Western countries, we're struggling with the problem of an ageing population that's increasingly costly. Yeah. And those are very sort of systemic challenges that it's difficult for anybody to be able to meet, because people don't want to pay more tax. They want to be able to enjoy a higher standard of living. But yet actually, there's a much larger section of the population that need to be supported by those who are in work. And those problems are not going to change. I think the challenge for churches is people are looking for a political salvation. I think there's a narrative that if one side wins, then actually that's going to be the end of the world, and therefore it has a heightened importance to people. And that tends to do one of two things. Either churches will tend to gather around one particular political view, and everybody in the church will share that sort of view. That might be reflected by leaders who make very clear that they think that is the right and the appropriate view. The other challenge is you have a church in which you try to keep the gospel centre and maybe avoid bringing politics into it, but actually in the congregation you have then very sharply divided views, and those emerge at moments. So this year we saw a tragic murder of Charlie Kirk, which I think revealed to some pastors and churches the diversity of opinion that there was within their church. So for some people in their churches, Charlie Kirk was a great hero, apologist for the Christian faith, who they'd been strongly influenced by. For others in their church, they saw Charlie Kirk and some of the things that he'd said about women and racial minorities as being a sort of a divisive and un-Christian figure. Another group who'd never heard of him. And events like that reveal, perhaps often to church leaders, the strongly held views of members of the congregation that don't actually come out in much of church life, but in a moment like that are suddenly brought home to them. And I think it's very hard for church leaders to lead well where there is such divisive political outlooks. And you can carry that into world events. So the situation in the Middle East between Israel and Gaza, and Christians divide in where they're who they support, who they think is in the right, who they think is behaving in the wrong, what the right and proper outcome ought to be to bring peace in the Middle East. And even over something like the Ukraine war, there are divergences of views about Ukraine and Russia and who's in the right and who's in the wrong in this situation.
And how it's going to get resolved.
And I think that it's very difficult for leaders in that situation.
What about in the wider Christian evangelical scene? Is there also that lack of cohesion? Is there a fracturing, or actually is evangelicalism more united than it has been? How would you look back over the last year and survey that?
I'd say a little bit of both.
Okay.
So obviously for some evangelicals who are taking very strong political lines, see fighting a culture war as the key thing, they are basically critiquing other evangelicals for not taking the firm line that they think others should take. So there are some evangelicals who, in a sense, I think have become slightly more separatist and critical of evangelicalism. They see it as a mushy centre. Having said that, I think that in the main, there is much more evangelical unity than there has been in the past. I think that the fact that we are such a small community within the UK as a whole, and recognising that so many challenges from the wider culture, that the need to stand together and work together is there. I think there is increasing unity between evangelicals at both a local level. So in many towns and cities, evangelical ministers and leaders are gathering together to pray for God to be at work in their communities.
Across lines, perhaps, where they wouldn't have talked to one another in the past.
I think in some ways the quiet revival has aided to that, because people have longed for revival. And historically, revival has not happened within individual kind of denominations or groupings. Revival has tended to touch all evangelical kind of churches. And that longing for God to work in that way has caused evangelicals to come together. So there are encouraging prayer movements that are happening at a local level. I think at a national level, I think the Evangelical Alliance, Gavin Calver's leadership there, that has been so clear and gospel-centred, has enabled evangelicals to come together. So I think whereas a sort of decade or so ago, Evangelical Alliance wasn't quite able to play that part for British evangelicalism, I think that has significantly changed and is being increasingly recognised. I'm on the Council of Evangelical Alliance and have been very grateful for the unity that is displayed there. And groups like Evangelical Alliance are able to facilitate conversations about some of these challenges that we face and enable people in very different perspectives and situations to listen to one another and to try to understand and to build unity.
What about our Anglican brothers and sisters? Because that's been another feature, isn't it, of 2025, what's been going on in the Anglican Church. Where's that at?
Well, there's a massive challenge there, because there are our Anglican brothers and sisters who are evangelical Anglicans who are in the Anglican Church but have relationships outside of the Anglican Church with fellow evangelicals, and we really value that sort of unity, which is manifested through things like gospel partnerships. It will be reflected in, if there is a UK gospel coalition brought together, as there's going to be, that will be another vehicle in which Anglican and non-Anglican evangelicals can sort of in a sense support one another. There's then the challenge within the Anglican Church itself. And I think this year the divisions within the Anglican Church have been very much sort of on show. The whole living in love and faith process, which was attempting to introduce blessings for same-sex relationships, potentially paving the way for the church conducting gay marriages. That has been something of a debacle in that the bishops have withdrawn that proposal at the moment.
Now have a blessing for a same-sex relationship.
As long as it doesn't look anything like a marriage. This is not because, as a group, the bishops don't think that's the right thing to do. They clearly want to introduce this. It's because they've been told that legally it would involve a change of doctrine, which is something that they, for a long period of time, denied. And that would therefore effectively require sort of very significant majorities in synod. So it is a total mess. So from the perspective of evangelicals in the Church of England who wanted no change, they've in a sense won a temporary reprieve.
Yes. And they are a minority, aren't they?
They are a minority, which is good. But whether there will be a real change of heart on the part of...
Sorry, it's not good that they're a minority. It's good that they've won that part of the battle. Yes.
And of course, then you've seen Sarah Mullally appointed as Archbishop of Canterbury, who... I think for those who are complementarian, here is somebody who is, as a woman, being appointed to the highest position in the Church of England. I think it shows how unstable the whole idea of having two integrities is, whether complementarian.
And indeed the worldwide communion, how unstable that is as a concept.
Absolutely. And Sarah Mullally is not an evangelical who stands for those truths and has been firmly clear in wanting to reject blessings for same-sex relationships. Now, again, that's garnered a lot of criticism. People have bemoaned the appointment of Sarah Mullally. I think we need to recognise that actually the Archbishops of Canterbury for quite a period of time have not stood firm for evangelical faith. So Justin Welby came from that background but proved to be something of a disappointment. Yeah. And at the end of his period, essentially said that he changed his position on gay relationships. Rowan Williams was never an evangelical and was always in favour of gay relationships. George Carey was evangelical, but from the perspective of the kind of complementarians, he is the one who made fundamental changes.
And has been campaigning for assisted dying.
And of course, before that, you had Robert Runcie, who was a liberal. So at one level... It's not a surprise. It doesn't change a great deal. There are lots of faithful Anglican local church leaders who are proclaiming the gospel, reaching their communities with the good news of Christ.
That's great news, isn't it? Let's just reflect at the end about how we've sought to serve churches over this last year. So it's been a challenging environment in all the ways you've described, the way churches are changing, the way churches are growing, sometimes rapidly, churches having to think about new premises and moving. So there are some challenges for church leaders, aren't there? We've tried to serve churches well. How have we been doing that over the last year, John?
Well, I think first of all, I think a lot of our church leaders on the ground are encouraged because they're seeing that growth. As I said, we've been helping churches that are finding greater diversity in their congregations. That's a good thing. They're rejoicing in that. They're just wanting to be able to learn how to do that well. As you say, I think for lots of our church leaders, what they've been coming to us with is the challenge of premises that are no longer big enough for them.
Yeah.
So numbers of conversations.
Or wanting to increase staff as well.
Yeah. Do they go to two services? Do they move to a different building? Do they develop? Do they grow? So I think it feels like a moment of helping our churches, often in a period of encouragement. We do also work among smaller churches. So our colleague Jonathan Bond is helping particularly smaller churches that are seeking to grow and helping to bring about revitalization. That's been encouraging. And we've been able to, in a sense, relaunch our work with church planting. So our colleague Graham Bynan has galvanized the work of planting. We've got a planters conference and we're providing coaching and mentoring for people who are church planters. Sean Robinson has joined providing support for planters' wives. So that's been an area, and we're seeing about 15 churches planted a year, which we're hugely encouraged about. I guess the way that we primarily try to help churches is we want to support and encourage leaders and leadership teams, building relationships with them. Absolutely key to that is our local directors. We're trying to have people all around the country who are there to support and help local church leaders. They're not just providing pastoral care for the leaders of churches or for churches that are in problems. They're helping churches in all areas of church life to think through strategy, to think through leadership, to think through training and raising up of the next generation of workers, to think through mission strategy in the life of the church. And since they're the connecting point between the areas of ministry that we centrally are thinking
about.
And
it's not a new idea, is it? We've had a director for London and a director for Scotland for many, many years, and that's been very fruitful.
And their other job is within their region, seeking to develop gospel strategy for the region as a whole by bringing churches together to think about how they can get the gospel out into their area, to learn from one another. They can both support initiatives and sometimes they can be the developers of initiatives. So one of the key things we've wanted to do is to gradually expand our local directors team so that there's somebody serving in every part of the country. We've made a little bit of progress this year on doing that. So we've had Simon Medcroft start working in Essex. We've had Michael Teutsch start working in central England. We've got a couple of new local directors that are going to be coming on stream in the new year. So that is a crucial way in which we provide on the ground support for our church leaders. And then within the central staff team, we seek to provide resources that will be helpful to church leaders, the podcasts that we produce, the articles that we write, the leadership consultancy that's available through kind of Ray Evans. We've set up mentoring groups for leaders at different stages of their work. One of the things that happened is Graham has been able to launch some of his in-progress webinars, which are training about areas of church life. So he's been thinking about worship. In the new year, he's going to be looking at sacraments. And those give groups of leaders the opportunity to think a little bit more deeply and theologically about key areas of ministry. Women's ministry has been a key area with our women's ministry our coordinators, Eleanor and Rachel. And we've gradually been able to grow the team there and to provide more support for pastors' wives and women's workers. So those are the things that we are doing. On the more practical side, we've been delighted that Becky Thomas has been able to join us full time as our church governance advisor, helping churches with a whole variety of issues connected with constitutions, policies. We've got a whole load of templates that are available to people, issues like safeguarding, finance, health and safety.
Yeah.
So helping local churches to make sure that they are properly organised. And run.
We've had a hugely encouraging year, haven't we? We're here to serve our local churches and to help our local churches. As you say, we primarily do that through helping leaders, wanting to see them flourish. We want churches to connect, don't we? We want churches to grow, and that's what really is driving all of this forward.
Absolutely. Yeah. And in many ways, the highlight of our year is our leaders conference, where we gather together, because that's actually where, as a constituency, we can be with one another. We form relationships with each other. We're encouraged by the preaching and ministry of God's word. I think this year's conference was a wonderful blessing. We had 1,100 people who were there. And I think we were really helped by making our focus the task of global mission, reaching people from all different cultures and backgrounds, Church Without Boundaries, whether that is in other countries or actually reaching people in our own country. And our eyes were lifted to the great work that God is doing around the
world. It was a great time, wasn't it?
And the gospel is growing, not just in the UK. We've talked about the quiet revival, which is relatively sort of small in numbers. Actually, around the world, the gospel
is
growing.
There's nothing quiet about it.
No. I mean, the growth of Christianity at present, and indeed over the last 100 years, has been quite astonishing.
Yeah, it has.
And I think as British Christians, we need to open our eyes to that reality. We can become easily discouraged. We just look in on ourselves. And we can easily lose sight of the great work that God is doing as he is gathering his people.
Yeah, John, that's a good place to end. Thank you so much for joining us throughout the year, actually, in lots of different podcasts and things that you do. It's been a great privilege to serve our churches. We keep reminding ourselves, and it's right to do so, that FIC is not about the central staff. It's not about FIC Towers, that we jokingly call our office building. It's about the work that is done in 660 local churches of all different sizes in all different places up and down the country, where every Sunday the gospel is preached, where midweek people are opening their Bibles, serving one another, reaching their communities. It's so thrilling to be able to serve leaders and churches in that context. What a great privilege it is, isn't it, to do that work? And we're looking forward to 2026 and the opportunity to do that further. So thanks so much, John. Have a great new year. Enjoy the fireworks. And we look forward to catching up with you in 2026.